Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Melissa Johnson. I'm the director of the Lung Cancer Research Program for Sarah Cannon. Today, Dr. Neil Love and I will discuss oncology today, promising therapeutic strategies for patients with progressive non-small cell lung cancer. Frontline non-small cell lung cancer has never been more complicated. We need a lot of biomarker testing in order to identify the best treatment for every patient. And so when people ask me, what do? I do start with NGS testing and PD-L1 for all. And of course, PD-L1 levels are one way that I make my frontline treatment decision. The other is how symptomatic a patient is or isn't at diagnosis. So for a patient that has a PD-L1 high tumor and no symptoms of their disease, I would consider a PD-1 inhibitor, pembrolizumab, cemiplimab, on its own. But for patients that have symptoms, I am increasingly attracted to the combination strategies of PD-1, PD-L1, and chemotherapy. And in some cases, like those patients that are PD-L1 zero, I am also thinking about adding in a CTLA-4 inhibitor with chemotherapy and a PD-1 inhibitor. We know that at 5 years, a percentage of patients are doing really well with single agent immunotherapy. But of course, that's the minority of patients. About 30% of patients are alive at 5 years. And so that means that some of the patients that we see in the office are going to be those patients and still be on their pembro or their cemiplimab or whatever their immune therapy is at 5 years, but the majority will not be. Somewhere in the 70 to 80% range are going to need more treatment. And so the PFS is also important to these long-term outcomes. How long can we expect patients to be without progression? And those numbers are much smaller. So for example, from KEYNOTE-189, when all patients received carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab, at 5 years, only 10% are progression-free. So this is just another piece of information from the data that we often cite that suggests that second line options are desperately needed for our patients. It's true that for other patients, we'll be able to add a little bit more with the addition of a CTLA-4 inhibitor, ipilimumab, or as we did in the Poseidon trial with tremelimumab. This trial showed us that when you compare patients that got durvalumab, tremelimumab, and chemotherapy, PD-L1, CTLA-4, and chemotherapy, with patients that got durvalumab chemotherapy, PD-L1 plus chemotherapy, and chemotherapy alone, there was a difference for those patients that got the extra immunotherapy agent, the CTLA-4. And so for those patients that are very hard to harness the immune system, that's what I think of doing.
Before you go on, I'm just kind of curious, I guess, doing what I do, I spent about an hour and a half earlier today going through some trials related to bladder cancer. And there, you know, it's kind of interesting. They have a positive Nivote study, they have a yes. positive Pembro study, but they have a negative Atezo study. And, you know, it's hard to see what the difference in the design is, why one would be positive and negative. And, you know, you see that all the time in oncology. Are there any trends that would suggest there are any substantial differences between any of these checkpoint inhibitors?
Neil, I don't really think that there are. The way I explain the difference in outcomes to myself is just that as time goes on longer, more and more patients gained access to PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor therapy. And so there were fewer patients that were totally naive and had only had chemotherapy. I think the best example of that is the avelumab trial in second line lung. It was the only trial that didn't show an improvement in overall survival in lung cancer with a PD-L1 inhibitor. And we would think that most patients get at least 3 months overall survival, irrespective of their PD-L1 level.
Another question I have, as you were going through your algorithm and the way you think through first line therapy, of course, we're talking about people without targetable mutations. I was curious what your thoughts are, your impressions are about what's actually happening in the so-called real world which you're probably more connected to than a lot of other investigators. Are there any, I don't know, misperceptions, disparities out there in that algorithm actually happening in this country? I'm always seeing these real world things that say the real world's not like clinical trials exactly. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually disagree with the dissension and the criticism of the U.S. community. I think it all started with a little bit of misinformation that came out of the MyLung trial that was reported by Mackenzie Evangelist from U.S. Oncology at ASCO a few years ago. And while she reported less than optimal testing rates, I think that there were a lot of hidden reasons that the testing wasn't optimal. The tissue biopsies weren't as good. The practice didn't know about liquid biopsy testing. There wasn't enough tissue left, and the patient couldn't undergo a biopsy because they were symptomatic and needed treatment. And none of that was elucidated. The other thing was that the data was a little bit old, or it was about 2 years old by the time it was reported. And in those 2 years, there were a lot of U.S. oncologists learning about how to do testing more facilely. What we never get around to talking about is the failure on the part of the healthcare system to help us with this testing. Every oncologist across the board understands that this is necessary for frontline lung cancer patients, but every hospital has a different answer to that question, and whether or not the testing can be done within 14 days is still an issue at hospitals like the one where I practice. And so if the patient comes to you and you see them before that 14 days, some hospitals aren't releasing the tissue for the testing to be done. And there are lots of nuances across the country about why that would be and the different problems that are that exist. It likely is going to be a regional or even a state issue to get this resolved, and it won't be resolved at the federal level.
What about the quality of biomarker testing that's out there, let's say specifically as relates to lung cancer? Obviously, as you were pointing out, PD-1 is such a critical biomarker. What do we know about quality? Who's doing these assays and the quality of them?
I think that's another good example of the ways that technology is improving and the biomarker testing that arena is changing day over day. I think for the most part, these days in the United States, most hospitals have the ability to do the companion diagnostic for pembrolizumab. We also have the ability to send out for other vendors. I suppose each hospital system, their predominant assay for doing the testing depends on the champion that started the conversation with the pathologists. I might say one other example of how testing is improving, and that's liquid biopsies. I think increasingly I'm hearing from the community oncologists with whom I partner that they like using liquid biopsies for all the reasons that all of us do, because the turnaround time is rapid, because it's easier, and the tissue issue doesn't become a barrier as often. And there are more and more assays that are offering not just NGS tissue results, but even RNA results and even HLA testing as a part of the package. So we're getting more and more information from that plasma-based testing, which I think is a step forward for all of us.
And it's maybe a challenge for docs in practice to figure out, you know, which assays may be more useful than others. What do you do when you have a patient who has metastatic disease, is a non-smoker, you're highly suspicious, but NGS is negative? You mentioned RNA. Is there a particular assay or set of assays you do in that situation?
I don't think there's a wrong answer. I just think you have to pick one and get good at it and get to know somebody that you can call at the company when there's a problem with tissue receipt, for example. And so when you jump around, you probably spend more time on the phone as a result.
So one more question before we get into second line and beyond is the patient who needs treatment before you can get your biomarkers back. I'm curious, you know, that's been a scenario we've talked a lot about in our education programs. We hear a lot. Initially, we're hearing a lot, hold off on the IO. Then I started asking people, suppose the patient's a heavy smoker. So I'm curious today what you do when you don't have your biomarkers back, but you have to treat the patient.
For a never smoker or a minimal smoker, I would just give chemo and wait on the IO. The reason is, as much as I don't want to give immunotherapy when I shouldn't, I've done it before. And the problem is that then when you get the EGFR testing back that shows the mutation, what do you do with the immune therapy? How long do you have to wait until the immune therapy is out of a patient's system? Just had a patient actually last week who ended up in the hospital with respiratory failure after two cycles of chemo, the first with immunotherapy, and then I realized she had an EGFR mutation, stopped, gave a second dose of chemotherapy to sort of wash out the immune therapy, and then started the osimertinib. About a month later, she ended up coming into the hospital, and I was sure it was because of pneumonitis. But in point of fact, she had congestive heart failure from the osimertinib. And it took us a while to figure that out because I was so sure that she had pneumonitis. She did have a pleural effusion. She had had a pleural effusion at baseline. And so I just thought it was cancer related and tapped it, didn't think much else of it. And then, you know, we did testing like a BNP and an echo and found that her EF had dropped to 35%. Her BNP was in the tens of thousands. And really, she started getting better with aggressive diuresis and wow, not with steroids. So all of that to say, you know, I guess I had a guilty conscience. I thought I'd, you know, given her pneumonitis and, you know, the right thing would have just been chemo for her.
Just out of curiosity, how long had she been on the osimertinib?
About less than a month. It was wow, 3 weeks.
Yeah. Wow. Incredible. So generally speaking, what do you do in these patients? And also, you know, we've heard over the years this issue of, you know, you don't want to have an IO on board when you use targeted therapy. And a lot of that came out of hearing about EGFR. At this point in time, what do we know about all the other targeted therapies that we use first line from that point of view?
You know, maybe the one that's the most interesting to me is KRAS G12C right now.
Really? Really?
Because we're learning that at least the sotorasib data that showed a little bit of transaminase elevation, showed a little bit of hepatitis, it may in retrospect have been because of immunotherapy. It's a little hard to prove at this point, but it does seem that when we give the KRAS G12C inhibitor up front, we negate that risk. And so I do think there's something to that paradigm that the immune therapy goes first and then the TKI is started pretty rapidly after, that we need to think about in all of our patients. It doesn't happen in all oncogene-driven cancers. And maybe the ones that where the TKI doesn't work as well, or maybe the ones that get a little bit of response to the chemo immune therapy, that middle group, MET, BRAF, for example.
I was going to say BRAF. Yeah, BRAF is the one I was thinking about.
Those are patients
Be smokers.
That's right. They can be smokers. I've treated, in retrospect, a BRAF positive patient got chemo RT followed by durvalumab for a year and did really well. And then we found some tissue in the freezer to do the testing. She has not yet recurred, interestingly. Wow. But in any case, I do think that IO hangover is an issue, but not an issue for every patient with an oncogene, certainly for EGFR and ALK.
So one more question before we get into recurrence. Just kind of curious at this point, what are you thinking about in terms of, you know, maybe cure? I mean, we talk about people who go progression-free for 5 years. Do you have patients in your practice you think who have been cured of lung cancer from immunotherapy?
I have a couple. I like to joke with my partner, David Spiegel, because he seems to have a ton. So I don't know what he's doing right, and I'm not doing it yet. But absolutely, there are people. I think where we're seeing it even more is in the early stage setting, when patients right. don't have any cancer left at the time of resection, and they are right. much, much more likely to be cured.
Right. All right, let's get into the real challenge, which is recurrence, and we start out here with ADCs, which is the hot topic.
Yeah, that's right, Neil. I took this table, which is a little bit busy, and we won't spend any time on it, from the educational book this year. Look at all the excitement, so much excitement that our colleagues that wrote this chapter thought that we needed to review basically all of the targets listed on this page. I describe antibody drug conjugates as smart bombs that attack the cancer and inject chemotherapy right into the cancer cells. And patients really like that idea that the drugs are targeted for the cancer and not the regular cells. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about TROP2 ADCs, because they certainly have been the darling of the non-small cell lung cancer community this year. TROP2 is a glycoprotein that none of us knew was so important or highly expressed in lung cancer until recently. It's also a marker of poor prognosis. We can see in the Kaplan-Meier curve, top right, that patients that had high levels of TROP2 expression did less well than patients that had no TROP2 expression. And so the star has been datopotamab deruxtecan, Dato-DXd. This cartoon shows very nicely the structure of an antibody drug conjugate. On the left, you can see the antibody, monoclonal antibody directed against TROP2. And then it's connected via the tetrapeptide-based linker to the payload, which is the bomb. In this case, an exatecan or topoisomerase 1 payload that's known as DXd. So the drug... the nickname for the drug is Dato-DXd. Some of the attributes of an antibody drug conjugate that are summarized on the right include the DAR, or drug to antibody ratio. It's really important, but it's a little misleading, because the DAR of this antibody drug conjugate is 4. We'll talk about trastuzumab deruxtecan. The DAR is 8. And we'll talk about patritumab deruxtecan. The DAR is 8. So it doesn't necessarily mean the drug is more toxic or more potent just because the DAR is higher. But what it does tell you is how many drug payloads there are per antibody. And so that does get at this idea that, you know, you only have to find the target in a few places in the tumor, and then it injects a lot of payload or chemotherapy into the tumor itself. So in October at ESMO 2023, we heard the results of the TROPION-Lung01 trial. This was highly awaited for a few reasons, not the least of which was because it is one of now a handful of trials in which all patients have received chemo and immune therapy. So what we used to quote as the standard after chemo, we've been saying for a while, well, we think patients do better after they've received immune therapy. So just keep that in the back of your head. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to this TROP2 antibody drug conjugate, Dato-DXd, at a dose of 6 mg/kg once every 3 weeks by IV versus docetaxel at 75, our old standby. And the primary endpoints were PFS, shown in the top right, and overall survival, which is not mature, but shown in the bottom right. So importantly, the PFS showed a statistically significant improvement in the time to progression for patients who received Dato versus docetaxel. So the first time that a drug has beat docetaxel, has a ratio of 0.75, significant p-value, The interval overall survival, you can see those curves are pretty much overlapping, but at least the hazard ratio is going in the right direction, and so we'll stay tuned. Now, at the bottom of the graph, and actually on the next slide, we'll see the primary endpoint PFS separated by histology, and this is where things got a little bit more interesting, in my opinion. Patients were enrolled irrespective of histology, and patients were stratified by their histology. So on the left, you see that indeed for patients with non-squamous cancers, the Dato-DXd was better. They certainly had improved PFS over docetaxel. But on the right, you see the squamous cancers. And in those patients, they actually did better with docetaxel. Look, you see the lavender curve on top and the pink curve on the bottom. And so this was a little surprising. No one was expecting to see that there was a difference. We certainly hadn't seen a signal in the phase one trial of this. And so this has made the community, I think, go, and is maybe one of the reasons that we haven't heard about the approval of this drug yet. You might say, Neil, looking at the left-hand side, that the reason that the non-squamous did better is because they always do better, and because that group of patients included EGFR and ALK and other actionable genomic alterations, those AGAs. But at the very bottom of the slide, you see the PFS hazard ratio for non-squamous without AGAs. So they took all the oncogenes out of that analysis, and still the PFS hazard ratio favored treatment with Dato-DXd. So it does seem to work better in non-squamous patients, and not just because they had alterations.
So I guess I'm curious if there are any hypotheses out there about why this histology thing was seen. Also, this may seem like a strange question, but what do you think a trial would show of docetaxel versus palliative care?
Oh, well, that trial's been done many years
really?
Ago, right? Yeah. One of the tax trials was versus another chemotherapy, vinorelbine, tax 326. But then there was another trial that was before that, that was docetaxel versus best supportive care. And the overall survival was in favor of docetaxel, even at that point. So that's why I think it became the standard drug in the refractory setting.
Well, that's a good reminder.
Docetaxel is an active drug. From my work with CodeBreaK 200, where sotorasib was compared to docetaxel, that was a humbling example and reminder that docetaxel is active across all non-small cell lung cancer, but just in a non-selective way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you feel comfortable, you know, buying into this sort of histology breakdown?
I buy this. What I know is that not all patients do well with Dato-DXd. I think if we go forward and talk a little bit more about toxicity, it didn't even really necessarily come out here. But what does come off the page is just this signal of toxicity in the GI adverse events, specifically stomatitis and nausea, right, which were higher in Dato-DXd than they were in docetaxel. You know, we consider both mucositis and nausea to be associated with docetaxel, right? Just they were considerably more associated with Dato-DXd. So Dato does have side effects. But across the board, if you look at the severe side effects and the adverse events of special interest shown on the right-hand side, the mucositis, yes, Dato was higher. A little bit of a higher rate of ocular events, dry eye and blurry vision. And then adjudicated ILD, that seems to be the side effect that's associated with the class, not just with this agent. You do see that there is a safety signal here. And I just wonder if the patients that I treated had some of these side effects that maybe were, in retrospect, were squamous cancers. And that's why I remember them not benefiting to the same degree. So this did answer a big question for me, because we participated in the phase one trial of this agent. And I remember thinking, gosh, my colleagues are having an easier time giving this drug than I am. And now I just wonder if maybe I was giving it to more squamous lung cancer.
That's interesting. You know, drilling down more, though, on the toxicity issues, one of the things that's kind of interesting in terms of the stomatitis is at the same time the lung paper was presented, there was a similar breast paper presented. And the breast people have a lot of experience with mucositis from everolimus and a lot of other drugs. And they are telling me that that works for Dato, but the lung people, I'm not so sure I'm hearing that.
It's true that that has been a difference that I've heard. Erica Hamilton, my partner,
right,
who's my neighbor,
sure,
she'll say the same thing, that you have to scare patients into using that mouthwash four times a day, the steroid mouthwash. Eating ice or sucking on popsicles is a new thing that I've heard that definitely helps as well. I wonder if maybe we'll get to a place in lung where we feel that way as well. And certainly in that case, then it does add options, right?
Well, the other thing is you're like among the last groups to get into the ocular story. We've already done a CME program just on ophthalmic issues in oncology already, particularly not just ADCs too. There's other drugs, erdafitinib, yes, et cetera. So like, and I still, even after doing that program, I'm not exactly sure the difference between, I mean, I know central serous retinopathy and stuff like that, but there's this other dry eye, et cetera. You've actually used Dato. Like, have you seen any ophthalmic issues?
You know, I haven't seen any ophthalmic issues with Dato. I do think their incidence is low. But, you know, I have always thought that you shouldn't mess with cancer patients' eyes. So it does feel as though it's something that we should tread very lightly around.
What's the thinking right now? You know, I kind of remember thinking before ESMO, before we saw the data, I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be second-line therapy. Breast, too, I was all expecting that. And they also, I think, are thinking through exactly how to process this. But I think it's maybe even more complicated in the lung. It sounds like you're maybe a little ambivalent about using this, or are you ready to go?
I think this will get approved. I think I'll have this as an option to use 6 months from now. I think, how can it not be approved in breast? I hear my GU colleagues talking about it. Now some of the trials are enrolling kidney and prostate. And so I think it will end up with an approval. I don't know whether it'll be tumor type by tumor type or if it'll be more agnostic. We don't know how to figure out who should get it. And I think that would help me give it a lot more confidently if I knew the patients that are sure to benefit because whatever biomarker was positive. I hear
non-squamous.
Non-squamous.
There you go. That's the best. I think that's the best you've got right now.
It is. You're right. I do hear that there's TROP2 expressed in the tongue. That's the reason for the mucositis, which
oh, really?
Is interesting.
That really is interesting. Well, the other thing is, you know, speaking of GU, you know, bladder's got first line IO plus ADC. I mean, it beat the hell out of platinum chemotherapy.
Yes,
and so
right,
that idea of IO, I'm wondering whether Dato in the long run, it's going to be IO Dato that's going to come. I don't know. You tell me. I know they're looking at it.
They're certainly looking at it, not just in bladder. They're also looking at
right,
it, I think, as we go.
Sure.
We'll talk about it in lung as well. And there may be some places, one of the trials I think that I wouldn't be surprised is positive is the TROPION Lung 08 trial, which is Pembro plus Dato for PD-L1 high. That makes sense to me. If you can convince the patient, you know, that the extra toxicity is okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was asking the GU people, why did they do so well? I mean, chemo and IO didn't do that great in bladder, but ADZ and IO, so I don't know. Interesting.
It is sort of like TKI and IO that also does well, kidney and bladder some.
Right. That's a good point. So, that's a,
you know, you wonder if you have to irritate the tumor in order for the immune system to find it. Well, let's move along to CCAM5. I think this is an experiment and an investigation that I think we can all learn from. The anti-CCAM5-701 that we'll learn got a name on the next slide was a different sort of antibody drug conjugate. And it was actually looking for CCAM5 expression on tumor cells. In this case, the payload or the bomb part was maytansinoid or DM4, which is another common payload linked to antibodies in antibody drug conjugate constructs. And there was high levels of expression of CCAM5, not just in lung cancer, but also in pancreas and breast cancer and gastric cancer in early studies. And so we saw the results of this phase one study of tusamitamab ravtansine. TUSA is a nice nickname for this one, at ASCO a few years ago. It didn't just enroll lung cancer, by the way. It enrolled small cell gastric and colorectal as well. Over the course of the trial, though, the patients with lung cancer were separated into those whose tumors expressed high levels of CCAM5 and those with moderate levels. And if you look at the waterfall plot in the bottom left, you can see that the patients that did the best on the trial that had partial responses were in green, and those were the lung cancer patients, and they were more likely to be high CCAM5 expressors. Moreover, the swimmer's plot on the lower right does show the duration of response and up to many, many months of treatment for many of the patients that had harbored partial responses. And so with this information as really the rationale, TUSA went forward into a couple different studies, into a large phase 3 that we'll talk about on the next slide, but also into a phase 2 open label study evaluating this drug in combination with, surprise, surprise, platinum pemetrexed to be used in non-squamous patients in the front line. So this was all lung cancer patients. You see the top arm, the navy blue arm, was just TUSA and Pembro. Then the maroon arm was TUSA, Pembro, and platinum. And then the green arm, those are the patients that got the quad therapy, Pembro, platinum, pemetrexed, and TUSA. This was a small study. You see single digits of patients in each cohort, but evaluating a couple different doses. And probably the thing that that bubbled up from this analysis was the grade 3 toxicity event rate, which was about 68%, and corneal treatment emergent adverse events related to any cause, 24% of patients. So this started to emerge as yet another eye toxicity that patients were having. On the right, you see a safety analysis of corneal adverse events reported in patients, not just lung cancer patients, all tumor types. That didn't seem terrible, 30% treatment emergent adverse events without any grade 4 or serious blindness, but keratitis and keratopathy in around 1 in 5 patients on study. You know, I think that in and of itself was a little sobering, but not a reason not to give the drug if you could figure out who to give it to. And so the phase 3 trial that was launched was Carmen LCO3. The schema is simply shown on the left-hand side. Patients had to express high levels of CCAM5 in order to be enrolled. And so and then they were randomized 1-to-1 to this selected antibody versus docetaxel. And the primary endpoints were the same as the Dato trial, PFS and overall survival. But the big difference was the selection, right? And so we found that we had to screen 20 patients to treat one on this trial. And that patient, as it turned out, got randomized to docetaxel, to tell a patient that you're waiting for a biomarker result, and then you don't get the biomarker directed therapy, you get docetaxel is challenging. I guess it's not that much different from a targeted therapy versus docetaxel, but that is the main reason that these trials are so unpopular. And it did take a long time to enroll. It enrolled really well in Europe, less well in the United States, and probably due to Dato-DXd and other competition is the reason why. Just at the end of 2023, we had a press release that announced that this trial did not meet its primary endpoint. And so it didn't improve PFS over docetaxel alone. And so the manufacturer would discontinue the development of the program.
So could you tell me a little more exactly what CCAM is? Is it CEA?
Yes, it's CEA, but expressed on the cell, on the tumor cell, and not freely floating.
Okay. And when you started talking about this, you were saying, you know, kind of lessons learned. Looking back on this, like, what did we learn? It seems like it looked like there was an early signal that didn't play out. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think if we go back a couple slides, you know, these are pretty small numbers. 11 patients in a phase one trial that were highly selected. These were patients treated for greater than 12 months. I think we assumed in the era of Dato-DXd and other TROP2 ADCs where selection was not required, that actually maybe you just needed a little bit in order for the drug to work, also HER2 low, and maybe a more sophisticated understanding of each of these antibody drug conjugates is what's needed. These drugs are really cool, but very sophisticated, and the degree to which the antibody binds for each of the drugs is different. The degree to which the linker and the payload are connected or cleavable is different. And how much of the payload can accidentally get cleaved and into the circulation unnecessarily or unwantingly is variable. And so I think to treat all of these the same probably was maybe the mistake here. But I think it was an effort to make a play in oncology and lung cancer in particular.
So, you know, it also brings up another thought that I've had, and I'm really curious about. We could probably spend a long time, but in terms of how research gets done nowadays, particularly compared to even 10 or 15 years ago, because for us on the outside, you know, it looks like industry is way more involved than they were 10 or 15 years ago. You know, I guess that's a huge understatement. But I'm always curious about how people in industry interact with people in academia in formulating their plans. Do you get involved with these kind of discussions? Do, you know, the people in academia, or is that all, you know, siloed inside industry? You're not exposed to it, or are you kind of part of it?
I think I can remember going to a steering committee meeting many years ago at AACR about this molecule, actually. But of course, at the time that any company is ready to talk externally about a molecule, it's been investigated thoroughly. I think probably many decisions have been made at that point. And at the time where someone in academics or someone that has experience across a number of antibody drug conjugates, just for example, might say, well, I might not do that. You know, the phase three trial's been inked, because unfortunately speed is king in drug development because it is so expensive.
And I also am curious about how they do it. You know, I can't even imagine, how do you sit down and, you know, with these kinds of budgets that must be considered and prioritize, you know, what you do, how do you bring in laboratory research? I'm just really fascinated. I wish I could learn more about it.
I do think that translation remains the magic, you know, that to see something work in the cell lines and in the mice, whether that's at an academic facility or in industry, and to take that into a human being is just a big leap, no matter how you slice it. And to assume that what does well in one should do well in another is limiting.
I mentioned that program on lymphoma the other day in Hodgkin, because, you know, one of the things I was noticing is they have a lot more intergroup studies than, say, lung cancer. And I guess that's because there are a lot fewer people with Hodgkin than non-small cell. It kind of makes sense. Is that also something that you're seeing, that industry is kind of going after the common tumors and the cooperative groups still have to deal with the less common tumors?
Yeah, but even in lung cancer, we're going to run out of patients. I think this antibody drug conjugate space is a good example of there's no way that we can treat all patients on a trial and satisfy all the trials that are out there right now. The KRAS G12C space is super saturated with trials in the front line. And so if we do those trials, then none of those patients are going to be able to do those do other trials in the second line. I see it every day in the phase one clinic. I saw an ampullary patient and a thyroid patient today. It was really hard to find trials for them, where the lung cancer patients have, you know, four and five options and they can't do them all. So there is a mismatch there, and we're missing opportunities to develop drugs, I think, in patients that are interested and available.
So I'm going to turn off my microphone and be quiet so you can get through your slides. I'm just, you know.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about another TROP2 antibody drug conjugate. Of course, sacituzumab govitecan is going to be well known to some of your audiences, Neil, because it's approved in breast cancer. The community oncologists have been using this drug for a while. It's new to lung cancer doctors. And so I show this phase one study. If you look at the bottom of the slide, this report was from the JCO in 2017. So this is in refractory patients, in refractory lung cancer patients who had not all received immunotherapy. So a long time ago. In this group of patients that were treated with this TROP2 ADC, at the time, I think the response rate was around 16-17%. The duration of response, 6 months, PFS, 4 months. And you might say, well, wait a minute, that sounds very similar to what we are expecting these days. But at the time, this drug was housed, or it was put back on the shelf, and it was evaluated in breast cancer. But of course, with the success of Dato-DXd, this came off the shelf and is being studied in a number of trials. This EVOKE-2 is a frontline lung cancer trial in which patients are receiving sacituzumab or SACIG with immunotherapy for patients that are PD-L1 greater than 50% and less than 50% in two cohorts, the navy blue cohorts, and then with chemo and immune therapy in the teal cohorts. Those teal cohorts have not yet been reported. But at World Lung last summer in Singapore, we heard the first results of this EVOKE-2 trial in the front line. And this is just a phase two trial with the response rate is the primary endpoint. And so I was excited to see this, that in patients that had PD-L1 high tumors, we would expect them to get around 35% response from the pembrolizumab. And we would expect them to get 20% or a little bit more with the sacituzumab govitecan from the past data. And look, they were getting 70%. So this is certainly at least additive between those two drugs. I do like the spider plot. It shows patients are staying on trial. They're having durable responses and they're continuing to be stable. And then the response rate in the group of patients, 50% and less, a little less strong, but nevertheless, you know, within the realm of the conceivable. And so this EVOKE-2 trial goes on. Now, even with this TROP2 ADC, there's a curveball. And that curveball, we don't have all the answers for yet. But EVOKE-01 is actually sacituzumab versus docetaxel. So this is the same trial design as the Dato-DXd TROPION-Lung01 trial that I just showed you. And it's very similar in design. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to sacituzumab, govatecan, or docetaxel. Main difference, sacituzumab is day 1, day 8, once every 3 weeks, as opposed to Dato, that's once every 3 weeks. In January, there was a press release that announced that the EVOKE-01 study did not meet its primary endpoint of overall survival. Oh yeah, that's the other big difference, is that while the TROPION-Lung01 was co-primaries, PFS and overall survival, this is just overall survival. So my hat's off for going big or going home. We haven't seen the results yet to know. They do say in the press release a numeric improvement in overall survival favored sacituzumab, and that was observed irrespective of histology in the study. So more to come here. It is intriguing, to say the least. What if the data in the squamous patients looks good? Could it be that this is the squamous option and the Dato is the option for the non-squamous?
Do we know whether or not the PFS was benefited?
It was a secondary endpoint, so it wasn't reported in the press release.
But I mean, at this point, we don't know that the data is going to be different than Dato, I guess, do we?
That's right. You're always so smart. The overall survival in the Dato Lung01 data was no difference. So you're right. Some of the answers are to be determined, I would say.
And of course, the big thing is you got the SASE plus IO coming along too.
Yeah, and that looked promising. So it's not it's down, but maybe not, and it's certainly not out.
I want to see the PFS based on histology for this.
Yep. And the other thing that I think will become more relevant, maybe even in the front line, is the difference in toxicity between these two drugs. These drugs are very different, even though they target the same target. That's fascinating
to
me. And again, underscores how these drugs are so different one from the other. The SN38 is the payload here with sacituzumab. So that's topo isomerase derivative as well, but yet no stomatitis, minimal nausea. This drug does have diarrhea, but overall seems to be tolerated differently. So,
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think in breast, you just hear more about cytopenias, not so much quality of life stuff. I never heard anything about stomatitis or eye things. So, yeah, I was curious. Yeah, I mean, SASE's used, we were talking about bladder. SASE's approved in bladder also, so it works.
Yeah.
That'll be very interesting.
And because it's already approved, you sort of wonder, the slide happens a little bit easier when you already have a drug approved in one indication to the other, as opposed to Dato that's not yet approved anywhere. So it's a fascinating race. All right, so we can go on. I've got a couple other ADCs that I just wanted to mention. Teliso-V has been a kid on the block for a while. We've been trying to figure out exactly where we should be given this drug. This is a antibody-drug conjugate directed against MET. It has been explored in patients with high, medium and low levels of MET expression in the tumor, and really found to be the most effective for patients with high levels of MET expression. So whether that's a wild type group of patients who just has MET over expression on the cell surfaces of the tumor cells, or if this is an EGFR patient population with MET as their acquired resistance driver, that seems to be the areas where this drug is being evaluated and tested. And so this TELEMET Lung-1 study design randomizes 300 MET high patients to Teliso-V or docetaxel. So this is yet again a trial in the refractory setting, still ongoing, but again has a pre-screening component, so a selection criteria that helps identify patients. So that is appealing to me, even though MET overexpression is not something that we routinely test for in lung cancer currently. And there are lots of others. Today, I saw patients in the drug development unit who were being treated with antibody drug conjugates against folate receptor, against Claudin-18.2, against CD71, against mesothelin. So there are a number of other targets. Of course, there are other payloads, even STING agonist as a payload in an antibody drug conjugate. And so in some ways, we're just scratching the surface of what's possible. Would be remiss without a mention of tumor treatment fields. This is a novel therapeutic. Can I even call it a therapeutic? Essentially, tumor treating fields are two electric fields that exert a physical force or gravitational pull. And so this is used to disrupt the proteins during cell division in such a way that allows the cancer cells not to grow and divide as usual, but actually instead to commit to cancer cell death. So it is a really unique mechanism and actually one without any treatment-related toxicity. And so why shouldn't we find a way to use it in lung cancer? The LUNAR study was reported at ASCO this year. It was much awaited. It did take a long time to enroll this trial, and patients were randomized to TTF with standard of care or standard of care alone. Now, at the time that the trial was designed, the standard of care post chemo platinum in the front line was either immune therapy or docetaxel. And so at the beginning, both of those options were allowed in the trial. But of course, IO moved up into the front line as standard of care. And so those two groups were separated for the purposes of analysis here. The primary endpoint you see is overall survival. And look, there is a difference. Median overall survival has a ratio of 0.74 and a significant p-value in favor of TTF treatment fields. But here we have, I think, where the rubber hits the road, if you will. This is the overall survival amongst the two groups that were treated in this trial. The patients treated with ICI plus TTF on the left and patients treated with TTF plus docetaxel on the right. That would be the current standard of care after frontline platinum immunotherapy. Of course, we see an improvement for patients treated with immunotherapy plus tumor treatment fields, but not for the chemotherapeutic plus TTF. It does help your imagination to suggest that as you disrupt the polarity of the cancer cells and stop the cell from dividing, that does induce some immunogenic stimuli, if not immunogenic cell death. But the truth is that will be hard to take forward in the frontline setting just because of all of the other drugs that patients are currently receiving.
What is that thing with the FDA?
We found a press release from early January that announced that a pre-market approval application seeking use for TTF fields together with standard systemic therapies following platinum was accepted. The application was accepted by the FDA, not that TTF was approved, but the application for approval was accepted, the PMA. So I think we'll see. I know that there are a lot of trials trying to take this one step further, both in the front line as well as in the third line setting. So after chemo RT, could you add TTF to durvalumab? And that's, unfortunately, we have heard recently that they're going to pause that trial in order to go forward with their frontline efforts. So I guess that's chemo immunotherapy with or without TTF. Everybody wants to be in the front line. I do think that the third line setting is interesting to me. That's somewhere where it just seemed like a simpler trial design and where patients might be a little bit more motivated to do it, but we'll see. I was disappointed to hear that that trial would go on pause.
Yeah, that is a shame because that's a great idea. Yeah, we've been following this ever since GBM, you know, waiting to see what's going to happen. I've always thought it was real interesting, but we'll see.
Just a couple more antibody drug conjugates that I wanted to mention, because these are also coming, I think, coming forward rapidly. One is patritumab deruxtecan. This is a HER3 antibody drug conjugate. So the target is HER3, which you'll remember is often complexed with HER1 or EGFR to stimulate downstream receptor internalization and signaling in a cancer cell. So EGFR mutated patients was a natural place for this drug to be tested. And so the first trials, including Herthena Lung 01, shown here, the schema for which Helena, you presented the data at World Lung in this summer, was in patients that had progressed on an EGFR TKI. You see a couple different dosing strategies were evaluated. The primary endpoint in this phase 2 trial was objective response. And you see the nice waterfall plot in the upper right showing a response rate of around 32%. About one third of patients had response to this therapy. This is a well-tolerated therapy, Neil. It feels different than Dato to me. Cytopenias are the most common side effects, some hair thinning, but not a whole lot else. This is yet another antibody drug conjugate being tested in a number of tumor types, including small cell lung cancer. Ifinatamab deruxtecan is targeting B7H3, which is shown at the top, the cartoon at the top. The waterfall plot's cool here because this shows all the patients that were treated in the phase 1 trial. So this, and if you look at the slide carefully, you can see many different tumor types included, including esophageal squamous cancer, prostate cancer, squamous lung cancer, as well as small cell lung cancer. And there were the response rate across all of the phase 1 trial was 40%. And exciting for us in small cell lung cancer, the response rate was 50%. So a promising target. It's being studied now in a phase 2 study to confirm the right dose in small cell. And we'll go forward in a phase 3 trial to follow. And one last one, CDH6 targeted therapy. This is DS6000. This is a cool trial that has also run at Sarah Cannon. It only enrolled ovarian and kidney cancer. Erica Hamilton presented this phase 1 data a couple years ago at ASCO, and we continue to enroll ovarian cancer patients in this. Just goes to show that, you know, there are a lot of places where these drugs seem to work. And we haven't answered the question yet. Could you treat any tumor type with an exatecan directed ADC and expect to see a response rate somewhere between 25 and 40%? I don't think we know the answer to that. But these certainly are hot drugs. They have resulted in collaboration between huge pharmaceutical companies. This is a small cell who you see she had shrinkage on this antibody drug conjugate. And then very next scan developed pretty significant pneumonitis, hypoxia, shortness of breath, and required steroids. So just when you think it's working well.
What ADC was it again?
It was IDXD.
Was the patient symptomatic?
Very. Came in short of breath, really? Breathing at 40. Knew something was wrong, and she assumed her cancer was back, and said, I just wanted to get to today. Like, what do we have to do? And I said, I think you have pneumonitis. And she got better rapidly on a prednisone taper. Pretty satisfying, but pneumonitis is, you know, a hex. So I couldn't put her on anything else, any other trials. She was a hard fit for everything else immunotherapy related because of the pneumonitis. So there is a cost.
How about your other case?
The other case is just a lady I saw last week, Asian female, never smoker. She was on OC for a long time, switched over to patritumab at 5.6. In the first cycle, her platelets went all the way down to 10. We transfused. We tried one more time, went down to 25, and so we had to dose reduce. I think we probably dose reduced, honestly, between 10 and 25, between cycle one and cycle two. And then she had dose delays subsequently, but we were always able to get her platelets back in range and keep going. And then in, bit by bit, developed anemia, required transfusion, did that dance for a few cycles, you know, transfused her up, got her ready to go, treated her. And then she, you know, continued to lose blood. So we dose reduced her again. She remains without evidence of disease now.
Wow.
After 2 years of therapy. So,
wow.
You know, she's done so well, but this is a potent drug that works at lower doses.
So, I don't remember hearing a lot about cytopenias with the other deruxtecans, TDXD, Dato. Did they see that earlier on as they were optimizing the dose, or this is you get cytopenias with this drug particularly? Because you had mentioned that.
This is it's fascinating to me how.
I mean, platelet count of 10.
I mean, you can't make
platelet count of 10.
I was like, do I need to send her for a brain scan? And she was like, no, I'm fine.
Wow, jeez.
Yeah. So it isn't interesting that, like, why would targeting HER3 cause cytopenias? I have no idea. It's the same payload as trastuzumab deruxtecan. So interesting.
So it is interesting. And thanks so much. I learned so much today. It was really great. I'll close by telling you I don't know if I ever told you this, the only joke I ever made up in oncology.
Tell me.
It's like, what would you call the name of a drug that was an antibody to HER3? Trastuzumab.
Did you make that up recently?
I made it up all by myself. That's the only joke I've ever made my whole life.
I can't believe that. That's a good one. I'll use that one if you don't mind.